duty free.
Sure. So what page are we on, Shyam? I have the paragraph. I think it's the one that goes, but it is evident that whatever the posture taken.
Yeah, that's the page that I'm on too.
And what page do you have?
It's 366 on the PDF.
Good.
Three 51 on the book, I believe.
Okay, so good evening, everybody, and welcome back to Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti, Chapter 2, in Book 2, Part 1 of The Life Divine. And we are in that part of the chapter towards the end. The last section, one may say, of this chapter, where Sri Aurobindo is launching into the primary theme of the chapter, which is Brahman, Maya, Purusha, Prakriti, Ishvara, and Shakti. And where we stand right now, Sri Aurobindo has taken us through the Brahman, Maya duality, and then moved on to the Purusha Prakriti duality, which we are still in at this point. And actually, from this paragraph that we are now launching into, he will begin introducing the third of these pairs, and particularly the third major uniting force, which is the Ishvara. Now, just to briefly recap, he has talked about Brahman and Maya, and I said that each one of these sets of terms forms a certain approach, a darshan, as they are called in Indian philosophy, or darshan translates as vision, world vision in that sense, way of looking at reality. A vision of reality. And each one of these visions of reality comes from a different set of texts and a different set of practices. So, Brahman and Maya belongs to the Vedantic tradition. Purusha and Prakriti belongs to the Sankhya tradition. And Ishvara and Shakti belong to the Agamic tradition, which is also the same as the Tantric tradition. So there where he starts, Sri Aurobindo's philosophy is a synthesis and an integration of all the strands of Indic philosophy, but particularly it may be called a Vedantic philosophy. Vedanta is at the bedrock of this world vision. And so Brahman and Maya are Vedantic philosophy, I mean, to back up for a moment and connect it to Brahman and Maya, Vedantic philosophy is primarily monistic. It is not monotheistic in the sense of the Abrahamic religions, where by monotheism we mean one God, one creator, one being that is superior to and the master of, the lord of, the many creatures of the cosmos, the cosmic reality or cosmic creation. Monism means there is only one. Ultimately, it isn't one God or one creator, but there is nothing but the one. Now, whatever we experience as the many or as the divided reality is not subsumed into a one that erases them, but are also self-appearances of the one. So this is Vedanta, and that one, to that one, it gives the name Brahman. Brahman is the only being there is. Whatever is Brahman. Brahman is all of the creation, Brahman is each of the creation, and Brahman is beyond any of the creation. Now, this radical infinite being, it's radically infinite, and hence its radical infinity makes possible its self-presentation in many orders of infinity, which are self-limitations, but which at the same time are in essence radically infinite. So to manifest itself, all these forms of self-presentation coexist eternally. Yet some of these forms may be forms which experience themselves in terms of a modality called time. In other words, as an infinite unfoldment. Yet they are at another plane of consciousness, eternally present as something which is eternally happening. It's part of the eternity of the existence of Brahman, part of his being. For that kind of a manifestation, what is necessary is a play between Brahman and it, the possibilities of Brahman. And for this play, the radical infinity that we know as Brahman must mirror itself as consciousness that probes its possibilities. I become conscious of myself. So this becoming conscious is the deployment of Brahman's consciousness, which is one of its primary properties. It is conscious being. Hence it is being, being radically infinite, and it is conscious, and its consciousness can view its being. And so these two mirrored infinities form what we call Brahman and Maya. And that's the first part that Sri Aurobindo deals with. Each one is, as it were, a self-knowledge of Brahman. Self-knowledge in terms of consciousness, self-knowledge in terms of existence. Hence, each one can be completely independent of the other, and yet be nothing other than the other. There is no difference between the two, and yet each can exist as a completely independent infinity. Then Sri Aurobindo goes into the discussion of Purusha and Prakriti, which comes to us from Sankhya. The reality of Brahman and Maya is not experienced by us in that way. It is only experienced in a consciousness that knows itself to be one and infinite. But the experience of reality that comes to us is the experience of divided reality, and a reality in which we find ourselves as conscious entities in relation with degrees of unconsciousness. And we either call it degrees of consciousness or degrees of unconsciousness. It's just looking at it like the glass half empty or the glass half full. So this experience of something in each of us that is conscious, and yet which is the center of our universe, and made up of the phenomenal experience of degrees of unconsciousness, leads to the notion of Purusha and Prakriti by Sankhya, which is another philosophy, not Vedanta. It has independent sort of existence from Vedanta in the Indian tradition. But a philosophy that became very important, it became, perhaps it arose in a post-Vedantic period, but it gained a lot of importance, particularly because people need a way to explain their own experience and have a starting point from which to arrive at reality with a different description. And indeed, we find from around the 5th century or 6th century before Christ, we start seeing a number of what one might call empirical philosophies of transcendence. They start from a kind of an empirical experience, the phenomenology of empirical experience. And assuming that, they try to arrive at a practice that will take us beyond the limitations of that experience and give us an answer. Buddhism is also the same. Buddhism does the same thing. So this could very well be a philosophy that arises around the same time as Buddhism in a post-Vedantic phase of Indian spiritual history. And it's a swing from the transcendentalism of Vedanta to a kind of empiricism from which to explain the Vedantic truth or some truth of transcendence to a larger number of people based on their own experience. So this philosophy becomes very popular and continues. And in a way, this philosophy is addressed by the Gita, which, again, we don't know exact the exact dating of the Gita, but it may be around the same time, around the 4th century before Christ or the 5th century before Christ, perhaps even contemporary with the appearance of Buddha and Mahavira, at least as a written text that is written into the Mahabharata. So we find that Sankhya is of great importance to the Gita, which couches its teaching largely and throughout with Sankhya as one of its referents. Later, past the millennium, the birth of Christ, the century of the birth of Christ, we come to a variety of philosophies which are using Sankhya. And so Sankhya remains a kind of bedrock to later Indian philosophies, which either address it or couch themselves in its terms. So this is why it's very important. And Sri Aurobindo is telling us what is Sankhya and what is the description of reality according to Sankhya and leading out of it. This description is a dualistic description, where that part which is conscious in us knows itself to be under the influence and under the control of the parts that are unconscious in us. We are subject to the forces of matter, the forces of life, and the forces of mind. Now, in Sankhya itself, the forces of matter and the forces of life, which we already find differentiated in Vedanta, are not so differentiated. Sankhya is more concerned with what it calls the inner instrument, which is really the inner mind, according to Sri Aurobindo, the mental instrument. So, this mental instrument, there is a mind even in matter. There is a mind in plants. There is a mind in inconscient things and in pre-sentient things. There is a mind in the rudimentary sentience of the plant life. There is a mind in the animal which is rudimentary, like that of the plant life. And there is a mind in us which is like that in the plant mind. That is called chitta. It is the subconscious mentality that is spread through the entire system. Then there is the mind of the senses, which begin organizing mentality in sensational terms. The sensations are partly vital and partly mental. So we find that we receive sensations, and the sensations are given a certain interpretation. First, a sensational interpretation that is more interested in interpreting things from a practical point of view so that we may act in a certain way on them. It is related closely to the vital instinct for survival and enjoyment, these two instincts. And so we find that we can react to sensory stimulus even before we actually try to cogitate about it, accept an understanding of it, or classify it in some way, put it in some kind of a category. That kind of mind is the sense mind, what Sri Aurobindo calls the manas, what Sankhya calls the manas. So, chitta, manas, and then there appears a third aspect of mentality, which makes its first appearance in animals. It's the property of thinking, of reflexivity, of being able to look at things from a detached point of view, to classify them, to correlate them, to analyze them, to create new forms by combining them, to understand their laws. That is the buddhi. So buddhi is intellect. Intellect makes its more full-blown presence available in the human being. And we see at once that evidently man, the human being, is primarily, at least in nature, an intellectual being, because that's what differentiates it from animals and other forms in which mentality is organized in more rudimentary ways. What makes the intellect particularly important, noteworthy, is that this is the first instrument of nature which can be free from the automatisms of nature. It has its own automatisms, which also could be called an automatism of nature, but it is free from the other automatisms of nature. It can stand back and not concerned with the survival or demise of its body, can study its body. It can do the same for its life impulses, its emotions, its desires, its impulses, its wills. So this ability to free itself from the various properties of the mentality makes it an ally to something which can be free of nature. And this is exactly what Sankhya is proposing, that there is something free of nature, because we experience ourselves as conscious, because consciousness is something that is experienced in contradistinction to whatever can be described in terms of laws. Consciousness as a pure reality must be free from all laws. It is conscious, hence it has independence from all laws. It has freedom and creativity. So this is what they call Purusha. And Prakriti is always in relation to Purusha. This is the thing about Sankhya. Sankhya will not talk about a Purusha which can be greater than Prakriti, nor about a Prakriti that can be greater than Purusha. The two are always matched. One can put the other to sleep, or can subject the other to itself, but that is only a set of relations. It isn't really a kind of a primacy of one over the other. So in that last paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is talking about Sankhya in these terms, and takes us through the fact that because of this intellect, we have one handle of nature through which we can move from the Prakriti to the Purusha. We can arrive at an intuition of this conscious being, and we can disavow. So that is the work of the intellect, to disavow our identification with the mental instrument, to see it as instrument only, as the Gita says, as karana, and to see Purusha as something which whose permission is necessary to every movement of the Prakriti. So once this is recognized, the Purusha is something which becomes the object of identification. The consciousness needs to identify itself with Purusha and see itself as Purusha only. And it does this by the help of intellect, which identifies for itself everything else as having laws and therefore belonging to nature. But if Purusha attains to independence, it is only an independence of witness. It is an independence first of the Sakshi, the witness, that observes everything in nature as if it is separate from itself, knows itself to be free of nature, and a free observer of nature. Then it realizes that, as a matter of fact, nature puts on its show for its own self. And this is where we begin to see that Sankhya is positing a relationship which has some kind of tacit unity between Purusha and Prakriti. If it doesn't only see itself, or see its other, observe the Prakriti as if it is an independent reality, but begins to realize that it has power over Prakriti, at least the power of veto, the power to stop its actions, that also makes it realize that there is some tacit unity between Purusha and Prakriti. It would be impossible otherwise to have any power over it. And yet, Sankhya ends over there. It is at most the power of giving sanction, Anumanta, which is the power of the Purusha over the Prakriti. And withholding sanction, it can make Prakriti fall into inaction, so that there is only a pure point of consciousness that remains. Now, this is the point that he's making over here. He's talking about this in that particular paragraph which has preceded this one. And in there, he's also making this point that there must be a tacit unity between Purusha and Prakriti, because otherwise it couldn't have any control over it. So as we see, I read towards the end of that last paragraph, Prakriti presents itself as an inconscient energy in the material world. But as the scale of consciousness rises, she reveals herself more and more as a conscious force. And we perceive that even her inconscience concealed a secret consciousness. So we see, as we said, that the conscious being in each of us is confronted by a world which is graded in terms of degrees of unconsciousness. But these degrees of unconsciousness are also degrees of consciousness. And what is there to say that the highest degree of consciousness that we are faced by is not the last? That as the rungs of consciousness arise in relation to us, both our own consciousness and the consciousness of the cosmos, the consciousness of Prakriti, are unfinished in their manifestation. So this is the point he's making, that consciousness is gradually increasing, and we cannot say that Prakriti is completely unconscious. Prakriti, since it is a gradation of consciousness, could very well be taking its source from something that is all conscient, just as Purusha could be all conscious, coming from that same source of all consciousness. Then he goes on to say over there, so too conscious being is many in its individual souls, but in itself we can experience it as one in all and one in its own essential existence. And this point is actually being made already by the Gita in answering the Sankhya's notion of an empirical experience of many centers of conscious experiencing. Each one of us is a center of conscious experiencing. So each one of us is a Purusha. So it's talking about many Purushas and one cosmos. See? So, or one Prakriti. And that is being contested by the Gita. That is saying that manyness is an artifact of one other property of Prakriti that Sankhya itself recognizes, and that is Ahankara or ego. And Sri Aurobindo says over here the same, similarly, so too conscious being is many in its individual souls, but in itself we can experience it as one in all and one in its own essential existence. This is actually the critique that links Sankhya to Vedanta. We are moving from a dualism or a multiplicity to what we can see as a radical monism of Vedanta. Moreover, the experience of soul and nature as dual is true, but their experience of their unity has also its validity. Once again, the dualism is now assimilated to a monism that does not erase their dualism, a complex monism. If nature or energy is able to impose its forms and workings on being, it can only be because it is nature or energy of being, so the being can accept them as its own. If the being can become lord of nature, it must be because it is its own nature, which it had passively watched doing its work, but can control and master. Even in its passivity, its consent is necessary to the action of Prakriti. And this relation shows sufficiently that the two are not alien to each other. This is the logical critique that Sri Aurobindo launches on Sankhya, to show that they cannot actually be dual, they cannot actually be separate, that implicit in the relationship is a unity. So this, then he says, then what is the duality? The duality is a position taken up, a double status accepted for the operations of the self-manifestation of the being. But there is no eternal and fundamental separateness and dualism of being and its consciousness force of the soul and nature. So that's how he assimilates this, the dualism of Sankhya, to the monism of Vedanta. In the next paragraph, of course, he makes that connection even more explicit, where he's bringing the Purusha. The many Purushas, the root of the many Purushas is the one supreme person, the one supreme Purusha, Purushottama. And the root of the ascending scale of consciousness in nature of Prakriti is the supreme nature of the supreme Lord or supreme person, which is Paraprakriti. In each of the gradations of nature, the spirit takes a poise of its being proper to that gradation. It's representing itself in that gradation of consciousness. And this we discussed last time as something which leads us to the knowledge that as Prakriti develops or evolves new properties and degrees of consciousness, so too Purusha comes to inhabit those as forms or degrees of its own freedom. Each existence of Purusha at every rung of Prakriti has its own degree of freedom and its own degree of power over Prakriti, conscious power over Prakriti. It is only with the appearance of the human that we find the manifestation of Purusha, which is in relation with Prakriti, can actually express enough of the Supreme Being that it can actually come into identity with the Supreme Being and can transform its nature into the Supreme Nature. This is why, in a way, even the Old Testament says that the human being is created in the image of God. It is created potentially in the image of God, because that potential is available to it. It is not the unknowable to it, but the unknown to it. And that's where we find that the human mental instrument that Sankhya is positing gives us a lever to the experience of the Purusha that can be its Lord, its controller. But that too is only a step in the way. And this is where Sri Aurobindo has brought us, because he is going to now take us up one more rung into the realm of the Ishvara and the Shakti. And this is the movement out of the Sankhya, or even a Vedantized Sankhya, into the Vedanta of Agama, of the Agamas, of the Tantras. And this is Sri Aurobindo's move to take us into a theistic world, which is at the same time Vedantic. So at this point, if you have any questions or comments, that will be good to take up, and then we can move to the next paragraph.
So, Debashish, is it correct to say that we will always have the same amount? Well, if Purusha and Prakriti are kind of poles that are originating from the same consciousness and have their own nature, and but Prakriti is coming from Purusha, and perhaps realizing more of its own nature, is Prakriti going to be transformed at all, or will it always stay the same amount as it with the in a pole, or other two sides of the pole? You've got Purusha and Prakriti, and will they always stay balanced? Or I guess it might also be how much we give attention to one or the other, but that may also be a factor. But does the Purusha transform the Prakriti, or I guess it would transform manifestations of it, but I'll just use, I probably see where I'm going here.
Yeah, Owen, I think that's a very profound question. It's a central question to Sri Aurobindo's thinking, actually, this whole issue. And that's also related to the discussion of Purusha and Prakriti, because is the relationship of Purusha and Prakriti one which only allows Purusha to observe Prakriti, to stop Prakriti, or to transform Prakriti? These are the three options. And so long as we are in the present Purusha Prakriti configuration, and that's where configuration comes in. You see, as he's saying, there is a Purusha and Prakriti to everything. There is a Purusha and Prakriti to inanimate things, in which there is the Annamaya Purusha, or Purusha of matter, and the Prakriti of matter. There is a Purusha and Prakriti to living things prior to the human, without the intellect, with some mentality or without mentality, mostly the Purusha of prana, which is dealt with in animism, you know, which is really everything is animated. There is a Purusha, a conscious being, to all of nature. Everything that lives has got, or even that doesn't live, has got this Purusha of prana, of life, and the Prakriti of life. But at these levels, it is not possible for the Purusha to emerge and do anything to its Prakriti, because it's completely under the control of its Prakriti. It has ceded control to the Prakriti. Now, at the level of the human, we begin tinkering with Prakriti, and this is the whole history of technology. We are born with the intellect, which is also to say we are born with tools in our hands. Because the intellect, to the intellect, it's not sufficient to just understand nature. To the intellect is also the urge to transform nature. And so from the very beginning, we find that we are trying to change nature, tinker with nature. And yet this tinkering is inadequate to nature. This is the big lesson of human civilization. We have come to the cusp of that particular understanding, where we know that we are stuck with these tools in our hands, the most advanced tools now, the tools of omniscience even, you know, a kind of a omniscient understanding of a mirrored space of knowledge, which we call cyberspace. So we've arrived at that kind of point in our understanding of how much we can transform ourselves. And we realize at that point that we are not adequate to it, that in a way we can't understand all of it, that there's always going to be some holes in our understanding. And even if we imagine that one day through extreme specialization we've understood it, or we've created the systems theory of everything, still we'll find that wholeness eludes us, because wholeness is another dimension than summation. Sankhya is summation. That's exactly what Sankhya means. It means to add together. And the mind adds together. But the other dimension, the dimension of the whole, is the dimension of the Purusha, beyond the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti, in which Prakriti has evolved intellect. And how can we get there? In other words, we are saying, or he's saying, that to the Prakriti, equal to the Prakriti is the Purusha. Sufficient to the Prakriti is the Purusha. You will not get any Purusha greater than the possibility is given to it by the Prakriti. So what are we going to do? So this is the reversal of consciousness, where Purusha takes the lead and transforms Prakriti by establishing within it new formations, new faculties, which it does not have now, which will allow the freedom to Purusha to experience its own conscious being. So the transformation that we are talking about, the transformation of Prakriti, is also a rebuilding of Prakriti. It's a giving to Prakriti, an endowment of new faculties to Prakriti by the work of Purusha, which is the work of yoga, basically. So this is indeed what Sri Aurobindo is saying. The goal of the human is the yoga by which the Purusha knows itself to be the Purushottama, the Supreme Being, and can endow Prakriti with the faculties that make her equal to that which can embody the Purushottama. In other words, Para Prakriti herself. Now, how can that be done? We are stating this in a certain way. We are stating it as if we can do it, as if this is the job of the human, the work of the human, as if even from a Purusha point of view, we can unite with the Purushottama by our own will. But we forget that the will belongs to the Prakriti. That to Prakriti belongs the power to give Purusha the new rung of its own being. To Prakriti belongs the power to establish the new faculties by which it will create adequacy for the Purusha or the Purushottama. So, this is what he's going to come to at the end of these paragraphs, where he'll tell us what is the Ishvara, and then he'll tell us that the work of the Ishvara is the surrender to the Paraprakriti. Because she alone who has created the ignorance can remove the veil of the ignorance. And that is the transformation. Yeah, sure. Para Prakriti, I said, which is the supreme consciousness force, the consciousness which in Vedantic terms is the Maya, that is the Maya. But Maya seen here as what he calls the divine Maya, the supreme Maya. And the term Para Prakriti is being used in the Gita. That is the Gita's term for it. And actually, you see, the Gita is interestingly a text that is straddling all these three traditions. The Gita is calling itself Vedantic. The Gita is referring to Sankhya. And the Gita is the foundation of all Agama. Because the Gita is glorifying Krishna as a person who is the Supreme Lord. And at the same time, it is glorifying the Para Prakriti, which term is being used by the Gita as the supreme conscious force. So we find that the Agamic tradition actually really rests on the Gita. The Gita is the primary text which gives validation to a theistic Vedanta. And that's what he points out earlier. The non-theistic Vedanta, which actually gives so much primacy to the principle, Brahman as a principle, he's pointing out that is not the true intent of the Upanishads. The true intent of Upanishads is individuation. It is the development of the Purusha out of the Prakriti. The dismemberment of Purusha, which is talked of in Purusha Sukta, and the reappearance from every drop of that dismembered Purusha of the totality of the Purusha. This return of the Purusha, the return of the person, is really what the theistic idea of Vedanta is all about. And this is what he's talking about here.
Devashish?
Yeah.
So, the Prakriti is, the Pava Prakriti, which is also within us, is kind of the soil, the terrain, and the...
Owen?
Yeah.
I can't hear you. Can you talk louder?
Oh, sure. I was saying that, can you hear me now? Is that better? Hello?
I can hear you.
A little bit.
Okay. I was saying that the Para Prakriti within us is kind of the soil or the terrain. And through that surrender process, which you're talking about, it opens up the door to Purusha, which will come in and tend to that soil, tend to that terrain, and create the new possibilities. Is that
No, not really, Owen. I know what you're saying. So let me clarify.
Thank you.
Yeah. What you're talking about actually is surrender to the prakriti. Is what you're talking about. The surrender to the para prakriti and the surrender to the prakriti are different. The surrendered, and you very aptly use the term the soil, because the soil is the foundation. The soil is the ground, the earth from which we rise. The soil is the inconscient, in which there is an intelligence, in which the para prakriti has involved herself. It is the involved para prakriti. What he's talking about is the evolved para prakriti, the para prakriti above, the para prakriti who is not going to open the way for the Purusha to tend the soil, but who's going to awaken the lower prakriti so that the lower prakriti will join with her and will get transformed, and in the process will release the Purusha to be who he truly is, the master of para prakriti as well as of prakriti. So this surrender is to the mother above, to put it plainly. There is the mother below and the mother above. The mother of earth and the mother of heaven. This is the mother of heaven. Because what he's saying is that now is the time. And this is also a very profound point that he's making, that spirituality is also historical. That the same thing does not apply for all time. That in the past, it was necessary to find either the transcendence outside of the cosmos or within the cosmos in some kind of, as you say, soil, the divine below, the Kundalini, for example, the surrender to the sleeping divine, who would then wake up and put us in union with the divine above. But that would be a process that would actually take us out of the mainstream of life and make it necessary for us to have the expertise of a great teacher who would know exactly what went wrong if something went wrong. But what he's saying is that humanity as a whole has now evolved to a point in the intelligence, in the collective intelligence, which is also therefore an individual intelligence. Each one of us has an intensification of the intelligence because we possess that collective portion of that collective intelligence of the time, of our time, that is cosmic enough to make possible the action of the mother above, of the para prakriti. So the surrender to the para prakriti, she is the one who has presented herself within the cosmos as the soil. But she was not the soil. The soil is a representation of hers. She is present as the soil, but she is much greater than the soil. She is the whole spectrum of the different manifestations of the cosmos, of the cosmic consciousness, and a being above. And that's the person, the Shakti, the Devi. She is the Devi.
That is very helpful. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Devishish, I have a question too.
Yes,
What's the relationship between the Western mind, which has gone way out in the development of rational intelligence, and this process that you're talking about, if any?
Yeah, John Robert. As a matter of fact, you know, one could say from a certain point of view, this development of the Western mind is what has made it possible for today for the higher Shakti to start descending. You see, it sounds almost, you know, contradictory, but see, what happens is that this division, the division by which the mind makes the world into its object, which happens through a number of phases, but particularly in our times, that Sri Aurobindo calls the cycle of reason. And this cycle of reason sort of begins in the modern period from around the 17th century, where we suddenly make a systematic effort. We realize that we can put our minds together to understand the laws of nature, and we can understand them if we make that a collective enterprise of all humanity. See, for the human being to understand the world in which it lives and itself, the human sciences and the sciences of the world. So we find that this process intensifies in our times and creates this division between the self and nature, the mind, which in some sense has kind of divided the world into itself and its other. So this particular process reaches a certain point, and we were talking exactly about that point, where, you know, it's like a chess game, where, you know, a great master who plays chess understands after about the third or fourth move whether he's going to win or whether he's going to lose. And yet, if that mentality is not there, the person would keep playing for many more moves and then realize that he has won or he has lost or whatever. But in the occult mind of our times, a certain understanding has already dawned that we have tried, the mind consciousness, the human mind consciousness, has tried all the things that it could try. And it has reached a point where it is now calling on something else to enter it. It realizes that it has reached the peak of its development in terms of its potential. And whether many individuals know that or not, substantial numbers of individuals are also awakening to that fact, even though they don't want to look to anything beyond that. And some of them do. Many of them today do. So this is exactly the point where the thousand-petaled cosmic lotus above starts opening its petals and the Shakti starts descending from above. No longer the Shakti from below, but the Shakti from above into the cosmos and into every mind, so that each mind that makes its surrender to that receives from that.
So are you saying that this kind of radical specialization of the Western mind has kind of reached the limit of mind, of rational mind, and in reaching that limit has turned unintentionally or whatever humanity's attention beyond itself?
Yeah, I believe that that's exactly what has happened. So that this extreme specialization that has taken place of the mind may no longer be something that works in the same way in which it was before, or for the same goals that it was before, because new goals may enter into the horizon, and goals and new ways of dealing with reality may enter into the horizon, which could keep that same specialization but use it in a different way. See, no longer with the intent of actually being the only power, being the spearhead of the control over nature, but an instrument, which is exactly what it was meant to be, a collective instrument that organizes reality and expresses it for the Purusha, for the Ishvara, that we will start experiencing as the truth of our being.
Okay, thank you. Very helpful.
Just on that point, I've thought for quite a while that the realizations that come from some of the people in the thinking of science and some of the cones that have come out of quantum physics, for example, the inability to see the complete picture of either position or I forget what it is now. I don't remember. It's position or wavelength, and being able to only focus on one or the other completely, so that you actually have to have a fuzzy view in order to see both, is one of the examples of, I think Gregory Bateson has written about the limitations of science as well, and started talking about the need for the spirituality. He wrote a book with his daughter called Angel Sphere, which talks about the limitations of science and the necessity to include spirituality. Mm-hmm. So science has been coming to, people who are scientists have been coming to that completely on their own without any necessarily any connection with the East at all. Sure. And those evolutions of ideas kind of meet very neatly. I thought this is just a lovely thing.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I think in a variety of ways, whether through science or through psychology, through the environmental movement, through a variety of ways, we are becoming aware of the fact that there is something where the mind stops, and it reaches its limits. And there is something that eludes our descriptions of reality, whether we describe it in terms of the subject or describe it in terms of the object. We come to a point of, the sort of indescribability, where there is the opening to something which transcends and which is known by other faculties and which ultimately spawns all the faculties, that is free and conscious. See, so that is really something which is beginning to dawn in a variety of ways, in a variety of minds. And I think the disciplines, whether you talk of the discipline of science, whether you talk of all the other disciplines by which modernity knows its knowledge enterprise, it's the academy, you may say, that particular body of knowledge is itself something that is developing new languages. And I think that is important. It's very, very important. It's not so important. I mean, it's not to, let me back up and say, it's one thing to jump off the cliff into the divine if we find that the mind has reached a certain kind of end. And it's another thing to take that as an opportunity to walk into space, see, with the very language that you started off with. And I think that is the real future. The future is not bringing in a spirituality outside of science, for example, or outside of psychology, but to expand the language of science, to expand the language of psychology or of whatever, to engage further and further in a field, into this relationship, to open up the faculties that will make possible the Purusha, the Purusha's expression in a life that we share.
Thank you, Debashis. That's really well put.
And in a way, I mean, say that that's really what gives a lot of, I mean, it gives us the scope of our work as human beings in this world. In this world, I mean, being in the world, as Heidegger would say, you know, we are, our being is a being in the world. And we find ourselves participating in the world and in the making of the world, in whatever way we connect with it. And we connect with it at some level through the lens of modernity, which is a lens of knowledge. It is a lens by which great systems of knowledge are being organized, and we are part of that organization. And we are participating in that organization, and we can have a part in transforming that organization. And so each one of us can actually create those new languages for ourselves in whatever field we engage with this world.
And it's exciting that we can create, but we can also reimagine what already exists in a language and the structures that are already there. We can see them through new eyes.
Absolutely.
John Robert, are you talking? Because I can't hear.
That was Owen talking, and I think.
I really couldn't hear. Sorry.
Yeah. He was saying that we can reimagine what already exists with new eyes. This is what he was saying.
Yeah.
So shall we read the next paragraph? We actually read it last time, but it will be nice to read it again.
Sure, I can go.
Okay.
We are on page 366 on the PDF. But it is evident that whatever the posture taken or relation formed in any individual notice of Purusha Prakriti, the being is in a fundamental cosmic relation, lord or ruler of its nature. For even when it allows nature to have its own way with it, its consent is necessary to support her workings. This comes out in its fullest revelation in the third aspect of the reality, the divine being who is the master and creator of the universe. Here, the supreme person, the being in its transcendental and cosmic consciousness and force, comes to the front, omnipotent, omniscient, the controller of all energies, the conscious in all that is conscient or inconscient, the inhabitant of all souls and minds and hearts and bodies, the ruler or overruler of all works, the enjoyer of all delight, the creator who has built all things in his own being, the all-person of whom all beings are personalities, the power from which all are powers, the self, the spirit in all, by his being the father of all that is, in his consciousness force the divine mother, the friend of all creatures, the all-blissful and all-beautiful, of whom beauty and joy are the revelation, the all-beloved and all-lover. In a certain sense, so seen and understood, this becomes the most comprehensive of the aspects of the reality, since here all are united in a single formulation, for the Ishvara is supracosmic as well as intracosmic. He is that which exceeds and inhabits and supports all individuality. He is the supreme and universal Brahman, the absolute, the supreme self, the supreme Purusha. But very clearly, this is not the personal God of popular religions, a being limited by his qualities, individual and separate from all others. For all such personal gods are only limited representations or names and divine personalities of the one Ishvara. Neither is this the Saguna Brahman active and possessed of qualities, for that is only one side of the being of Ishvara. The Nirguna, immobile and without qualities, is another aspect of his existence. Ishvara is Brahman, the reality, self, spirit, revealed as possessor, enjoyer of his own self-existence, creator of the universe and one with it, pantheos and yet superior to it, the eternal, the infinite, the ineffable, the divine transcendence.
So this is a paragraph which is really like a great hymn to Ishvara.
More like poetry, right? So
it's more like poetry, exactly. It's like poetry. He's got a few thoughts or ideas in it. He begins by saying that thing there that we just discussed, that Purusha and Prakriti are in relation in this entire sort of scale of consciousness, and in each individual they are an individual nodus of Purusha Prakriti at each rung of the ranges of consciousness. But everywhere, as he's saying, even if Purusha appears to be overwhelmed by Prakriti, it's because he's allowed himself to be overwhelmed by Prakriti. That is the one with the will. Purusha has will, and that will is being embodied by Prakriti. Prakriti is the one that is manifesting that will. So ultimately it is Purusha's will that has become the higher cosmos and the lower cosmos, but the one that executes it, through whom that particular will is manifest, is the Prakriti, the Shakti. And this is a very, very profound point, because this point comes up, you know, in Sri Aurobindo's discussion of avatarhood in the essays on the Gita, where he's saying the difference between all other souls and the avatar soul is that the avatar soul is the will of the Ishvara self-manifest by using his own para-prakriti, not by the division whereby para-prakriti is given the freedom to manifest the will of the Ishvara. So even there is this tremendous difference, and that becomes the avatar, the Purus. But all other souls are really one, what one might say, using the literal sort of terminology Sri Aurobindo uses, we are all children of the Divine Mother, all born out of her body, born out of her soul. And we are in relation with the Supreme Lord. This is the theistic central myth, metaphor, or symbol which unites this entire thing together. But the reason why Sri Aurobindo doesn't use that kind of terminology explicitly is exactly what he'll tell you in this paragraph, which is that you can't think of this person or these persons in terms of what we understand of persons being limited by the limitations of the ego. They are as impersonal as they are personal, because they are infinite. So,
Davis.
Yeah. Yes, Owen.
I kind of cut out. I'm not sure if anyone else did, but you were. If you wouldn't mind, when you're finished with that thought, or whenever you have a chance, kind of, because I didn't hear you mentioning how the Purusha and the Prakriti are manifesting within the avatars, and how that was different. Looking forward to hearing that.
And then well, yeah. What in the essays on the Gita, what Sri Aurobindo is saying is that the Purusha, the avatar, in the avatar, the Ishvara manifests his will directly through the use of his own para-prakriti. In other words, he's self-manifest, swayambhu, as the term is used in the context of Shiva, self-become. The avatar is the Swayambhu of Vishnu, just as all the kind of lingas are the Swayambhus of Shiva. So this self-becoming of the Ishvara is the process followed by the avatar, while the other process is the process whereby the para-prakriti creates the embodiment of her relationship with the Ishvara, her love relationship with the Ishvara, that creation is all of us. We are portion of her portion. We are manifesting her will, which is the same as the will of the Lord, but passing through a duality which unites through love.
Okay.
And then, of course, after making that point about the Purusha and Prakriti being tacitly united with the Purusha as the Lord, he moves to talk about what is the truth of the Purusha. The truth of the Purusha is the Ishvara. And then he launches into this great hymn, this poem, you know, which is suddenly... You know, the poetic side of Sri Aurobindo come to the front in such a way that you find all the properties of the Ishvara being adulated, actually, just adored and adulated in that long passage. He tells us essentially how to look at the Ishvara. He's telling us in that passage that the Ishvara is everything there is, and we have to become multiple-minded to relate to the Ishvara. Just, I mean, he partly this is a device that has its own logic, you know, in his logic, because he's trying to tell us, and right after that he'll tell us why he's doing this. Because he's saying, don't think of this as a person like you think of yourself as a person. It's the multiple person. It's got all these properties. You can relate to it in all these ways, and you must relate to it in all these ways, in every way possible. Because this is not like the God of the popular religions. This is the infinite being. This is as impersonal as it is personal. Because infinity can only be mapped to impersonality. And yet, it is a person. It is the center of the circumference-less circle.
Just one question. I'm just curious. Would you be able to say a little bit on the relationship between this Ishvara and the time and time?
So, actually, that's a very profound question, because ultimately, time is the Shakti. See, because Ishvara is the Lord, so the Lord belongs, and as he's saying, Ishvara is also manifest as Purusha at every level of the Purusha's appearance along with Prakriti. So the Purusha-Prakriti doublet, you know, or, you know, this single thing with two entities to it is the Ishvara. Ishvara is entering into all these manifestations, but it is given that manifestation through a certain kind of time structure. A time structure of evolution. A time structure by which its different potentia can be manifest as an exploration, as a kind of exploration, a systematic exploration. So, this systematic exploration, which is yet creative, is a specific kind or modality of being, which is being as becoming. And that is time, that is the body of time. Therefore, this is the reason why Ishvara Shakti relationship is the relationship between Kala and Kali. Kala, who is time, which is just as Krishna shows it in the Vishwarup, he says, I am time itself. I am time, risen to slay the peoples. Now this I am time is basically that spread of the possibilities as an idea in the mind of Ishvara, an idea that is infinite, an infinite idea. And that infinite idea is a mode of being, being as becoming, being as time, as Kali. So the Supreme Being Purushottama is experiencing himself through these varieties of ways, of each one of them being infinite. And this particular way is due to his consciousness describing him in those terms, here in terms of becoming. Which is time itself. So, in our experience, this is a very big enigma, because there is, one may say, even a certain kind of inequality between our experience of space and our experience of time. Space seems to be, ideationally, not empirically. Empirically, space is always conditioned by time. Subjectively, also space is conditioned by time. You cannot think of the same space in the same way at two times. But ideationally, it's possible to think of a time in which all time exists, a space in which all time exists. You see, it is like a kind of mental construct. But as we try to think about it or develop the mental construct, we see that it doesn't work. Because if time is infinite, space also has to stretch infinitely, and there is really no end, no beginning to that space and no end to that space. See? So being and becoming are actually, as he points out over here, Brahman and Maya, both equally radically infinite, both self-presentations of the unknowable.
I mean, in this becoming, is there any sense of relative, or what kind of becoming is
that? So, when we are talking about becoming, then becoming itself can have a number of modalities. Now, one can be a modality, actually, the when we talk about becoming down to its most empirical layer, then we are talking about what he pointed out earlier, those three properties of Brahman, the third property of Brahman, which is the property of exclusive self-concentration. So in that exclusive self-concentration, it is as if there is only relative realities and relative times. See, everything is relative to something else, but there is no absolute to anchor it. That is the at the empirical level of time, and that is avidya. That experience is coming due to exclusive self-concentration of Brahman in each of its instances, each of its aspects. But even that is actually not really true. It is just a kind of a range of perception. Beyond that range of perception, one starts finding that this exclusive self-concentration is itself fuzzy. So actually, I would like to say to that argument about the fuzziness of matter, that matter is fuzzy. It's not that that our descriptions are fuzzy, but it is itself fuzzy, because exclusive self-concentration is never completely exclusive. It is something which only puts to the background everything else and puts itself forward so that that which is in the back seems not to exist. But it all is there, only the concentration is pushed in a certain direction.
John Robert, would you like to read next?
I think I'd rather listen this time. Thank you.
Sure. Anybody else? Margaret?
Yes, I can read. The sharp opposition made between personality and impersonality by our mental way of thinking is a creation of the mind based on the appearances of the material world. For here in terrestrial existence, the inconscient from which everything takes its origin appears as something entirely impersonal. Nature, the inconscient energy, is entirely impersonal in her manifest essence and dealings. All forces wear this mask of impersonality, all qualities and powers. Love and delight and consciousness itself have this aspect. Personality makes its apparition as a creation of consciousness in an impersonal world. It is a limitation by a restricted formation of powers, qualities, habitual forces of the nature action, an imprisonment in a limited circle of self-experience, which we have to transcend. To lose personality is necessary if we are to gain universality, still more necessary if we are to rise into the transcendence. But what we thus call personality is only a formation of superficial consciousness. Behind it is the person who takes on various personalities, who can have at the same time many personalities, but is himself one, real, eternal. If we look at things from a larger point of view, we might say that what is impersonal is only a power of the person. Existence itself has no meaning without an exit. Consciousness has no standing place if there is none who is conscious. Delight is useless and invalid without an enjoyer. Love can have no foundation or fulfillment if there is no lover. All power must be odious if there is not an almighty. For what we mean by person is conscious being. Even if this emerges here as a term or product of the inconscient, it is not that in reality, for it is the inconscient itself that is a term of the secret consciousness. What emerges is greater than that in which it emerges. As mind is greater than matter, soul than mind. Spirit, most secret of all, the supreme emergence, the last revelation, is the greatest of all, and spirit is the Purusha, the all-person, the omnipresent conscious being. It is the mind's ignorance of this true person in us, its confusion of person with our experience of ego and limited personality, the misleading phenomenon of the emergence of limited consciousness and personality in an inconscient existence that have made us create an opposition between these two aspects of the reality. But in truth, there is no opposition. An eternal, infinite self-existence is the supreme reality, but the supreme, transcendent, eternal being, self and spirit, an infinite person, we may say, because his being is the essence and source of all personality, is the reality and meaning of self-existence. So too, the cosmic self, spirit, being, person is the reality and meaning of cosmic existence. The same self, spirit, being or person manifesting its multiplicity is the reality and meaning of individual existence.
So here we find that Sri Aurobindo is extending the theism that he has introduced in the previous paragraph and complicating it by making us realize that this person is not different from or does not negate an impersonality and must in fact have a certain impersonality, but that impersonality is not the same as an abstract reality. That impersonality is still full of personhood. And that is the point that he's making over here, that it's a logic, the logic for what is today called emergentist thought, the thought of emergence. And what is emerging? What is emerging is the person. So in a way, this is a certain kind of a mysticism which is closely related what relates closely to it is the Christianity of Piet Teilhard de Chardin, who's saying that in fact it is the person, call it Christ, and he would call it Christ being Christian, that person is the one that is appearing in every being, and then that person is the one that will be realized as the one person in every being. So this is what he calls the nousphere, the consciousness, the cosmic consciousness in which the one being is realized in all its infinite possibilities and portions. And this is also the emergentist theories, sort of ideologies that is coming into more contemporary times in terms of individuation, the idea of individuation that has entered into chaos theory. There is an attractor, and the attractor to all formations that try to arrive at a point of conscious survival and mastery over its environment. And systems move, evolve towards that. And that is another way of defining the properties of the emergence of the person. And the person is the one person there is. That is Brahman. And that is Purushottama. That's what the whole Ishvara part of this, Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara is all about.
Devashish.
Yes, Owen.
In the one in Pierre de Chardin, in the relationship that you're drawing to Aurobindo, talking about this, the person and the one person, cosmic person, Christ being in each of us, I was reminded of the passage in 1 Peter about the hidden man of the heart, which is not corruptible and inside of us, but let it be the hidden man of the heart in that which is not corruptible, etc.
Yeah. Yeah, that is definitely the mystical understanding of Christianity, undoubtedly affirms this very thing that Sri Aurobindo is talking about. Only thing I'd say is because of the more profound metaphysics of seeing that in all things, Christianity tends to be a little more anthropomorphic or anthropocentric. It is more empowering of the human. But if we look at it, yes, we'll find that the same thing, this person is present at every rung of the creation. The person exists. And that's the whole notion of the avatar. The avatar is the emergence of the fullness of the person at every rung of the evolution.
Yes. And regarding the anthropomorphism, which I think is very important point you're making, and especially since one could say that this is not gender equal language, but in reality, in my understanding of the esoteric meaning of man in the Bible, it is a manifestation. Man is short for manifestation of God. So anyway, that's just a little more subtle way of looking at the word.
Sure. You know, it may also, see, we were just talking at the beginning of this sort of today's meeting, I was talking about the manas, you know, the point from which the mind, you know, which itself is made up of that term, mana. So this mental being, in a way also sort of informs the word man. Man is in a sense not so much in its origins, not gender specific, but you know, sort of differentiated in terms of the unique faculties from other creatures.
Very interesting.
Because in the Indian system also you have the Manu, you might know Owen. The Manu is the creator of each population of, you know, actually the creator of a cycle, I suppose, of, yes, a human cycle. You see, what Sri Aurobindo would call a human cycle. The progenitor of the human cycle is a Manu. And he says the Manu presides over that particular, in occult formation, that Manu, that ideal man or archetypal man, presides over that particular
epoch,
yeah, of humanity, or even sub-epoch of humanity.
Or yuga, perhaps.
It's a kind of yuga, yeah. He does say that kind of a Manu presides over yugas, each yuga, and there is a Manu that presides over the kalpa, etc.
Devashish, you were talking earlier about manas in relation to animism.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's this emergence of the person in that. Wrong.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, John Robert.
And when a shaman, for example, has communication with some being, some spirit of an animal or of a tree or a mountain or something like that, is that involved?
Yeah, undoubtedly. Actually, the thing is there, what is happening in terms of the emergence of individualism, or the, not individualism, individuation, which is really the emergence of the person or of personhood, we find that, you know, the mother talks about this quite a lot. Say, for example, in the world of animals, each species is ruled by a hierarchy of occult beings. Like, there would be, which she's used the term, the genius of the species, which is a being that sends messages. And that's how these particular worlds have a certain ecosystem that is pretty tight, because the occult beings are in harmonious relationship with each other, and they are implicitly obeyed, completely obeyed by the all the sort of internal mechanism of the animals. So within that particular system, that becomes an automatism. They're all following those patterns from that occult being. So the person, just like we were talking about the Manu, this is like that Manu, the mind of that class of animals. However, something more can happen, which is that an animal can develop a degree of personhood that exceeds that of its mind. This is the emergence of person, that there is a certain kind of, and if it really exceeds it by a lot, that can only be through an avatar. Because only the avatar knows way into the future what is to come. Even the greatest sage who can break the boundaries of a certain level of, let's say, even humanity, is not able to see far enough. Or, you know, even an animal that can actually show what Sri Krishna refers to as the vibhuti, you know, powers, that are extraordinary powers that exceed normalcy of other animals, yet they can't break the horizon boundary of the animal, which can only be done by the avatar, who unites the past with the future.
So would we say then that the one form of communication between a human adept and an animal or a plant might be with the master or spirit of the species, which might be a way of naming the occult beings that you were talking about. And another form of communication might be with one of these avatars or vibhutis of that species, but individualized in a particular
instance, a particular instance. Yes, yes, absolutely. Those are, I think, very, very true, John Robert. And I think both of those ways of relating are open to people who want to relate consciously. Because, yes, we can come into contact with the genius of the species if we actually make the attempt to come into contact with it. So it's a greater mind, as it were, of that particular animal type. The mother was doing that kind of thing. You know, in particular instances, she'd contact the genius of the species, and she'd be able to even work out pacts. For example, she has talked of that very interesting case where she was walking with a few people along a mountain path in Pondicherry, after she was there. She saw with her vision, before they turned the corner, that there was a snake there, a cobra. And she communicated with the snake, saying that, you know, we are coming, so why don't you step aside? And then through that, she contacted the queen of the snakes, the genius of the Nagas, and worked out a pact with her, saying that you will not hurt any of my children. And so the snake went away, and she has said that a number of times, snakes will not bite you in this area, because I have a pact with the queen of the snakes. And there's another one which is a little more humorous, because apparently Sri Aurobindo, after he broke his leg, was lying down, and he was getting bitten by mosquitoes. So after some time, suddenly these people saw that the mosquitoes had stopped coming. And then Sri Aurobindo says that the mother must have made a pact with the being of the mosquitoes. And he said, that's not a very good idea, because it's better that they bite me and have their normal ecosystem than make a special exceptional case of me, because then they'll bite somebody else. They'll go to other places and bite people over there, because they're sparing me. So I remember that those were some instances of the mother's pacts with the beings of the genius of that particular animal. But, you know, the other instance you talked about is even more interesting. And I believe the mother has talked about this just in passing somewhere. But what it is that in relation, animals actually also have souls that evolved from sort of from rung to rung of consciousness. And that is one of the ways of the emergence of the person. Because in a particular species, a certain soul will, in relation to something greater than it, develop the aspiration to house itself in a more adequate nature. And that will be an emergence of the person. And this is why you find that sometimes human beings, if they enter into relations with certain animals, see that those animals start, you know, expressing qualities of personhood. You know, in most cases, of course, it may be a delusion, because human beings usually relate to animals, you know, even as pets, in a kind of a projective kind of way. You know, we sort of project our unworked fantasies onto these animals. But if we were not to do that, but to relate in consciousness, expecting a person in that animal, that would evoke the emergence of personhood in that animal. And that would also invoke an aspiration to be born as a person in another genius, like another rung of consciousness, or another grade of consciousness.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Debashish?
Yes.
In the last paragraph, would you mind, he uses the word person and he capitalizes it. This is, well, obviously we must learn these things through the experimental method ourselves of inquiry, but in terms of the definition that Aurobindo is laying out, it is the kind of the Atman plus, it is the conscious, what can potentially become conscious within us, kind of a probably a broad definition, but certainly I think what he's saying is the person is on the conscious mind and the ego, but far beyond that.
How do I define it? Okay, see, firstly, what's interesting, again, if you look at the words themselves have got a lot of power. You know, Sri Aurobindo's words are packed with power, and this power is actually at working all the way down from meaning to the very cells of the body. You know, it's kind of material. It's like matter. It's a kind of subtle matter. Each word is a subtle form of subtle matter. And this, what he's saying over here with the person, person is Purusha. In fact, those two words are Indo-European equivalents. And there, the Purusha he's talking about there is the Purusha with a capital P, which is the definition of the Purusha in the Veda and the Upanishad. Because the Purusha term is used because the central, one of the central myths of the Veda, the central hymns of the Veda is the Purusha Sukta. And it's really about this, that the single person, the one person there is, that person multiplies itself, it divides, it's not multiplies, it self-multiplies through division, basically. It divides itself, and in each of its divisions it is present, and hence it has multiplied itself through self-division. And that particular sort of, you know, I mean, self-expression and understanding of Purusha is given a philosophical basis in the Upanishads, where Purusha is the person that emerges out of the impersonality by its own power, because it was always there. So what is the person, you know? The person is ultimately shrouded in mystery, because it is arising. It's, as I said, the center of the circumference-less circle, you know. It's arising without cause, because it's the only person there is. But it's an infinite person. It's a person that doesn't even know its bounds. And so one way or mode of its being is to know its own bounds, which are infinite. See, without beginning and without end.
Thank you very much. Beautiful.
Shall we break here and plan to continue next time?
Sure. So we are next time we'll begin the paragraph, If We Admit the Divine Being.
Sure. Yeah, page 368 we'll read next time.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah. Thank you, Debaji.
Will it be evening or morning?
Oh, yes. Good question. I mean, I've been getting a few emails from people who could attend the evening classes, and that includes some people from Australia, and is Olga here today?
No, she's not.
Okay, she's not, but she's being able to come, and then there's some others who have written to me saying it's a little more convenient for them, and otherwise they won't be able to attend. So I'm wondering if it's not completely very difficult or impossible for anybody in this group over here to make it an evening thing like this.
It's fine by me. If there are others who feel differently, let me know.
Works well for me.
I like you guys.
I can manage it. I can do either.
Okay, so why don't we leave it in the Saturday evenings, two Saturdays from now?
Well, the two Saturdays from now, I think, is the first weekend in June, isn't it?
Okay, so I won't be here for that. The first weekend in June.
Yeah, not only that, I think we are usually meeting like second and fourth Saturdays.
Exactly.
Okay, so which is the next one?
So I think the next one should be 13th June, I believe.
13th June will be fine, I think. Yeah.
So two Saturdays will be skipped in this case.
Yeah, okay.
Debashish, I will be in San Diego then. I mean, I think I can certainly join from there.
Sure. I think we're from wherever you are. If you can just make a little time, you'll be able to join.
So we'll continue on June 13th, Saturday, at the same time, 7:30 Pacific. Break the call now and continue that.
Okay, very good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.